Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go to bbc.co.uk/5live.
Simon, thank you. Enough Simons, I think. Let's bring in a Mark. How are you doing, Mark?
I'm fine. Can I just very quickly, before we do anything else, just clear this up? An email from Christopher Morrish says, I sat behind Mark in an evening with John Stewart on Sunday, and when the questions and answers section of the show came, Mark was extremely eager to ask a question. Didn't get the opportunity. What was it? Well, I have no idea. A, I don't know who John Stewart is. B, I wasn't there. And C, I can bet you it was either Mark Cousins or Mark Lamar.
Almost certainly.
But not me. Is it, who is John Stewart?
Don't know. John Stewart Mill?
Was extremely ill, and half a pint of shandy could be...
Particularly ill. Yes, could stick it away.
Half credit whiskey.
Two old men doing Python.
Let's not do that now. Anyway, sorry, just to get that out of the way, you know.
Yeah, Daily Show on More 4, that's who he is. He's a comedian.
Okay. Well, I'm sure he's great, but it's a television
show. Should we build up to King Kong?
Well, yeah, so it's absolutely up to you, but I think we have to allow it some breathing space.
Okay, how long would you like? It's the same question to Seth Lakeman, because I wanted to know how long I needed for his song. How long do you think we'll need for King Kong?
I think
loads of emails about it already.
It'll take slightly longer than Seth Lakeman's song, which actually instantly was sounding fabulous.
It was excellent.
And, I think once we get to quarter two, we really have to embark on it.
Okay, we'll start it before then. Anyway, to matters of correspondence, many of which arrive about 9 o'clock this morning.
Yeah.
Phil Dowse says, thanks particularly for Mark's reviews last week of The Chronicles of Narnia.
Yeah, here we go.
With Christmas always being a time when cash is at a premium, I was particularly delighted when Mark informed me that the lion dies in the movie. Having not read the books as a child, I'd been tempted to watch the film as it looked stunning. However, I now believe this is an integral part of the story, so thanks again for saving me the cost of seeing the film. Perhaps Mark could speak to J.K. Rowling and find out the end of the final Harry Potter book to save me a further £10. I suppose he's going to go further this week and announce something truly outlandish, like in King Kong, the monkey dies.
Yeah, well, I think it sounds from the tone of that his irony gland is working, because I think even as she is saying it, they are aware that it... But as I said before, you know, all you need to know is it's a biblical parable. And if it's a biblical parable, the chances are that the heroic character will at some point desist, and then at a point after that... rise
again.
Mayo
at bbc.co.uk 85058. And speaking of giving away the ending,
so there we go.
Let's talk to John Pienaar, who's in Brussels at the European Union summit. Give away the ending, John. How's it going to finish? Plenty of movie correspondence. We'll get to King Kong the other side of 3:30. Ben in Cambridge.
Right, you're clearing your throat. That's always bad news.
It's a reference to last Friday when you reviewed March of the Penguins.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure everyone would agree that Mark is an entertaining chap most of the time. And his opinions are quite often spot on. Last week, however, I listened in exasperation to Mark's take on March of the Penguins. Rather than actually reviewing the film, he decided to promote the opinion that it is evidence of an intelligent guiding hand, as he put it. Mark, you are a film reviewer with a PhD in horror fiction. I, says Ben, am a scientist with a PhD in zoology. I have seen the film, and take it from me, there is not a single feature or behavioural trait that cannot be explained by natural selection. Please remember that it is a profoundly non-random process. The genetic mutations that underlie it are indeed chance events, but the selection part of the process, while they are still natural and requiring no guiding intelligence, it is distinctly non-random. And there's plenty more.
Can I just say that, you know, as I always say on this, the great problem with determinism is it means you can never say thank you for passing the sugar.
And in what sense is that an answer to Ben's intelligent...
Well, how long have you got? Because clearly I've already, you know, exhausted my patience with...
Anyway, he concludes, I could explain to you the details of the Penguins right now, but I expect you have a show to do, correct? If you want me to send you the details, I'll be happy to do so. Or better still, perhaps you could just read a science book or two. There are plenty available that even exorcist fanatics can understand.
Right, can I just say, in reference to that, it is possible for anybody to look at a rose and say there is an absolutely rational explanation and that is all there is. And it is possible for somebody to look at it and say, you know, I don't think that happened by chance. And I have one view and he has the other view and that's fine. It's a great... I'm not promoting a particular view. It's just, honestly, my own feeling is you look at some of the things that nature does and you go, that's an accident.
Sorry, I was just wiping my nose.
Yeah, I know. I realized you moved to tears.
I was moved in any way.
And explain this to me. How did the fish get out of the water? That's what I want to know. Anyway.
Yeah, contact drive on that one. 3:15. We'll actually do some top tens and some movie reviews in just a second. Woody Allen's going to be on the programme on Monday.
He is. Shall I trumpet?
Go on then.
I'm doing Woody Allen on stage on Saturday.
He's coming out to our house for a curry tonight.
He's back in my car at the moment, writing a script.
So Woody Allen on Monday's programme. Coming up, the King Kong review. That'll be after 3:30. If you've seen it already, because it opened yesterday, mail at bbc.co.uk. Top 10 this week. Nanny McPhee at 10.
I liked it. It's crawling its way out of the charts, but hasn't it done well?
March of the Penguins at 9.
I think covered in some depth.
Yes. The Constant Gardener at 8.
You know, up for loads of awards in the forthcoming awards season, no doubt. I think Rachel Weisz is very good, but I don't think the rest of the film is as good as it's cracked up to be.
Mrs. Henderson presents, number 7.
Quaint, 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 that's enough quaintness, Ed.
Number 6 is Doom.
Which is rubbish. I imagine that the computer game is better, but then that's because it's a computer game and not a film. And to clarify a point that I think I clarified last week, I'm not saying that computer games are rubbish, I'm saying that films of computer games are rubbish.
On the subject of the film at number 5, yeah. Cliff in Great Yarmouth went to see The Exorcism of Emily Rose, an interesting, well-acted film. Tom Wilkinson was excellent as the priest, although as the film was inspired by real events, in inverted commas, I found it quite disturbing that his character was presented as a largely sympathetic one, despite the fact that the priest's religious dogma and backward thinking indirectly resulted in the death of a young woman. As Mark's favourite film is The Exorcist, could you ask him where he stands? Oh, no, I'm not. On well, the whole devil
no,
possession.
But
you've already pronounced on matters religious. I'm not sure we should
I know. Can I just say, however, that there's another version of that story coming out, a German film, which I think is called Requiem, which apparently sticks much closer to the details of the original case and should be quite interesting. If you look into the details of the original case, it is very, and as you know, of course, the Tom Wilkinson character is a sort of fictionalised version. Well, everything is fictionalised in The Exorcism of Emily Rose, but Requiem looks like it might be interesting.
And let's carry on with the top 10, because that's at number 5. Keeping Mum at 4.
Rubbish.
Flight Plan at 3.
Nicely
cinematic?
Filmed. Rubbish.
Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire,
number
2. I
actually couldn't say cinematographed or whatever it was. And Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, like it very much, except that it's not as good as Prisoner of Azkaban, but it is better than the first two. And if you have young kids, they will find the end distressing. And incidentally, on this question, because I have been asked about this a lot, the thing about the end of the movie being distressing, it's distressing for anybody who has any sense of, you know, sort of moral involvement in the story, because something really tragic happens. It's not necessarily that it's just scary, because it is scary, but something actually really disheartening happens, as you know as well, because you've seen the film, read the book. So it's not necessarily a terrible thing for people to be upset. I'm just warning you that the younger members of the audience will be upset.
And probably made slightly less upsetting by the fact that an awful lot of the kids will have read it and know precisely what's about to happen.
Although apparently that hasn't made any difference with Narnia.
That's true.
The Lion!
UK's number 1, The Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe.
My advice, the same as before, prepare children for... I know this whole don't give away the ending. Incidentally, of course, that's not the ending. If you know the story, it's not the ending. But if you are taking younger children to see The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, you may be best advised to prepare them by giving them some background on the story.
That's the top 10. That's what's around. You can go and see one of those or try a new one.
The Family Stone. It's one of those, you know, Christmas family together movies that just inspires festive acts of really bad behaviour. It starts and ends, minus a postscript, with Diane Keaton looking longingly out of a window. Snow is falling, tears are starting to arc down her cheeks, but she is putting on her brave face.
Is someone ill?
Well, someone is ill, and guess who it's going to be?
Oh, the dog?
No, it's Diane. Oh. She's got that non-specific movie disease that enables you to be terminally ill without looking it at all. And then you occasionally, or sit down and someone says, are you all right? But you know they're not. And then they're brave all the way through. And it's a movie shorthand for saying, you know, engage sympathy with this character because they are undergoing a really terrible thing, but I'm not going to go into the details of it. She is the horrible mum of a horribly right-on family. She has a gay, hearing-impaired son with an African-American boyfriend who are in the process of adopting a non-racially specific child. So that ticks a whole bunch of boxes at the beginning. And the plot is then that her son, Dermot Mulroney, is going out with Sarah Jessica Parker, who's uptight and prickly and awkward and doesn't understand how to get on with this fantastically laid-back family with whom she has to go and spend the family Christmas. Sarah Jessica Parker and Rachel McAdams, accompanied by Simon having a slurp of coffee.
I thought that slurp of coffee was actually on the soundtrack.
Even in the process of that clip, I started to get bored. Now, here's the thing. Sarah Jessica Parker, who, amazingly enough, has been nominated for a Golden Globe for her performance in this, is incredibly irritating as the uptight businesswoman who goes into this family. But in comparison with the rest of the Family Stone, she is a shining beacon of human warmth. And frankly, she, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if she just ran amok with an axe because they are that annoying. Firstly, take it to Dermot Mulroney, from who you could make a great, huge, big heap of firewood, because by heck, Dermot Mulroney is about as wooden as... It's like, why is there a chair sitting on the sofa? Oh, no, sorry, that's not a chair. That's Dermot Mulroney. Why is that woman hugging a wardrobe? That's not a wardrobe. That's her fiancé, played by Dermot Mulroney. Diane Keaton is on her ghastliest form in years. You know the way, guys, it's the upturned collars, it's the quirky look, it's the chin forward, everything that Diane Keaton does that can be really good also has the flip side, the baby boom side, which is really, really irritating. And in this... she begins in irritating meltdown form, and then she proceeds to ooze this fantastically annoying right-on charm that just makes you think, I don't care what you have. I don't care about your family. I'm with the woman you really don't like in all this. Claire Danes turns up in the movie. She doesn't want to come at the beginning. And then when she turns up, she spends the whole of the movie attempting to leave on a bus. And you're going, please, please let us come with you. It's just grisly. It's like one of the... The poster, incidentally, is absolutely ripped off Love Actually. And in comparison, Love Actually is a searing, straight-to-the-heart-of-the-human-condition drama that really gets to the dark, foul underbelly of, you know, the seasonal condition. I mean, it's just appalling. And as an indication of how appalling it is and how much... an entire cinema discovered that it was appalling together. I saw this in a screening packed with the critics, and two-thirds of the movie, well, more than that, so three-quarters of it, the movie appeared to end. You know, it faded to black. Diane Keaton, it faded to black. Sound of a chair getting up. Screen came to life again, and a voice of a prominent, and I have to say very, very well-liked American film critic went, oh, God! And the whole of the rest of the critics went, yes, we feel the same way! It has to, and it was absolutely loathsome.
So it's nothing to do with Sly and the Family Stone. You don't get the family, you know, it's a family affair or anything like that.
No, none of that at all. It is an interesting double bill with this thing called Calvaire, which I was going to review last week, and if you remember, was Film of the Week.
Film of the Week, and you didn't tell us anything.
I didn't manage to get to it because we ran out of time. Okay. Calvaire is a French-Belgian seasonal horror film about Laurent Lucas, is this cabaret singer who heads off south for the winter. He breaks down in a kind of Brothers Grimm-type woods environment. He is taken into an inn, which you should clearly not go into, which is run by Jackie Barroyer, who promptly mistakes Laurent Lucas for his wife, and it then descends into a hideous bunch of torture and ordeal. In French, Calvaire can mean martyrdom, the ordeal, living death, but obviously Calvaire comes from Calvary, so it implies the martyrdom of Calvary. And actually, if you understand the stuff that I've been rabbiting on about, it's no coincidence in saying this all happens around Christmas. That's why these movies get released around Christmas. The thing has this strange kind of religious parable arc to it, which ends up with Laurent Lucas taking on him the appalling sins of the village into which he wanders, which is populated entirely by people who seem to have wandered off the set of The Wicker Man. It's really nasty. It's really gory, it's really sadistic, and it's actually strangely uplifting at the end. But I kept thinking, what I really want is Philippe Narhon. Philippe Narhon is great. Philippe Narhon is the greatest guy from Soul Contra 2 and Switchblade Romance. He's a legend, particularly amongst fans of the nastier, extremer end of horror.
Hang out with an awful lot.
No, I've never met him. He's a legend.
No, the fans of the darker end. That's what I was thinking.
Oh, yes, I have gone to the dark side, yes. Well, you keep wanting to pick Philip Nolan up in a van and take him over to visit the Family Stone and spend a few minutes sorting them out before coming back to the film. The director of Irreversible, Gaspar Noé, said of Calvaire that it is sexier than Deliverance and funnier than the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And I think that that's exactly what it is. And honestly, of the two Yuletide festivities, Black Christmas, White Christmas, you know, the really scary horror, and I'll tell you which one was the nastier, was the Family Stone.
Phil in London and March of the Penguins still dominating a lot of the email traffic. Further to your previous contributor, I have a PhD in theology. Could you tell the chap with a PhD in science to stick to proving positives rather than trying to prove a negative, i.e. the lack of divine intervention? Could you ask that in future he refrains from commenting upon a religious matter that is frankly beyond his remit?
And can I just say, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin?
Why would you want to say that?
Well, this, you know, to do with evolution and spirit and blah, blah, blah.
Ben in London. Science is not an opinion like a film review. It is either accurate and testable or not. Please read a few science books. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm very impressed, however, that our listenership all appear to have PhDs. Since we have a very small amount of time for the news, can I just throw one movie review away very quickly? Are you going to read another?
Only Martin in Manchester, and then you can...
Oh, there's more. Okay, come.
Martin in Manchester. Mr. Kermode, I don't understand
Dr. Kermode.
He says Mr.
Well, he's wrong.
Okay. I don't understand how that happens, therefore it must be God. Well, I don't understand how the piano won 3 Oscars, but it doesn't mean that it was a product of divine design. It's just not a sustainable philosophy, Mark. Stick to movie reviewing, please.
Well, actually, that I can't argue with, because that is a very good...
The world's most miserable film.
Yes, it is awful, isn't it? It's like, you know, hoik the piano over the side and be done with it.
It's raining again.
It is.
In the words of Supertramp, what were you going to do before?
Very quickly, Screaming Masterpiece, or in its original title, Gargendi Snilt, as far as I can tell, which is a documentary about the Icelandic rock scene. And it's got everyone from Björk and Sigur Rós and Snowblow, and a very annoying little appearance by Damien Albarn. And then Fredrik Thor Fredriksson, the filmmaker, who turns about. It is everything you never wanted to know about the Icelandic rock scene, but were worried that you were going to be told anyway. And at the end of it, you think, you know what? Iceland does seem to be a pretty rocking place. I mean, I'm not a huge Björk fan, although I'm a great admirer of her stuff. I can't ever remember the last time I thought, I have 5 minutes to spare, I must put in that one in which she imitates a fax machine. But it was an interesting... It is the best documentary about the Icelandic rock scene of the week by some distance.
Steve... It says it's generally considered that the fish got out of the water in order not to be standing but in drying pools. Those that made the short flip-flop across the shallows back to the mainstream survived. Those that didn't weren't so well adapted. It's a very clear case of evolution.
They had to develop...
It's all accidental. It's a huge timescale thing that isn't.
They had to develop lungs immediately in one single leap, which is why most evolutionists now agree that evolution didn't happen in an arc. It happened in a series of jumps, in a series of quantum leaps.
On the matter of movies, Colm listening in Helsinki. Well, folks, after 5 weeks of Mark banging on about Red Eye every time he tries to talk about flight plan...
I didn't this week.
In particular, the abilities of a young Cillian Murphy. He has influenced the world. Such is the power of his words that young Murphy has been nominated for a Golden Globe. Not actually for Red Eye, but nonetheless, it was Mr. Kermode's influence all the same, I am sure.
Well, one can only hope so. I mean, Cillian Murphy doesn't need anyone's influence for everyone to recognise how great he is, because he is a fantastic actor and he is really scary.
Back on March of the Penguins, the French original included a beautiful soundtrack and several haunting songs in English. Does Mark know why these are not included on the English version?
Well, every single language version of the film has its own... They've redubbed it for every version. And in each version, the narration is done by, you know, a different... And I imagine a celebrity. Like, for example, the version that's playing in China is narrated by somebody who's very well known there. And I think that what's happened in each territory will be to do with licensing agreements and to do with them looking at the market and thinking, to whom is it the most widely marketable? So that'll be it. I mean... That's not only for that film. There's loads of cases of movies which have different soundtracks in different territories. I mean, think, of course, about Legend, the Ridley Scott film, which has the Jerry Goldsmith score and also the Tangerine Dream score. I mean, the same film, just totally different scores.
Paul Hemmings on this. Right, I'm settled down with a nice cup of tea, readying myself for Mark's Kong review. Having only seen the trailers, I'm more than willing to admit that it looks good, but my overriding feeling is the same as I had when I saw the original, which was, what a stupid story about a giant monkey. Anyway,
it's not a monkey. It's not a monkey. It's an ape.
Maybe there is more, but how did it evolve?
How did it get out of the water?
Maybe there's more to it than that. The Kong review to come.
Very quickly, just to preempt this, to say the one really unanswerable question, and it's in all versions of King Kong, is how do they get the ape into the boat? And that's, you know, much more, how did the fish get out of the water? How did the ape get in the boat?
Mayo at bbc.co.uk. Five Live. Simon, thank you very much indeed. It's 3:36. Five Live. Andrew, on this, and we'll say this is the end of the evolution.
Yeah, I think we should draw a line under Mark and theology.
Okay. Read the current debate over March of the Penguins, Simon. Yeah. I have a PhD in political science.
We've got a really classy form of readership.
Everyone, people listen, not read, by the way, to the radio.
What did I say?
Readership.
Well, my mouth said readership, but my brain said listenership.
Boy, you're bright. So, everyone actually has a PhD or is entitled to one.
Yes.
I have a PhD in political science and was mostly struck by the interracial harmony demonstrated by the black-white penguins. If only we could harness their harmony for post-conflict situations like Iraq and Sudan. You know, there's a point which no one else has picked up on.
And an off-air news bulletin from Andrew, who reported that, apparently, in France, March of the Penguins has character voiceovers a la Johnny Morris in Animal Magic. And he says that he has it on very good authority that this is true, and apparently it's charming. I mean, it sounds ghastly, but apparently it's charming.
And John, on this, further to your PhD contributors, I have a first-class honours degree in philosophy and can clearly prove that due to the problem of induction, nothing is provable. And can have a damn good time proving that they don't exist. Now, can they shut up, please, and have a King Kong review? Well, yes, but there's a Lassie review, so we'll get to the ape after the dog.
Didn't Jean-Paul Sartre famously say that his mother hadn't given birth to him because he couldn't remember it, to which his mother said, well, I remember it, Jean-Paul, only she said it in French.
We'll get to the ape, but first the dog.
OK, it's the latest version of, you know, the shaggy dog story of Lassie, which has basically got the country's press in a froth using all the kind of, you know, oh, it's a dog's dinner, it's a dog's mess, it's a bad dog, blah de blah de blah. Lassie, the main objection to it seems to be, well, it's a really stupid story in which Lassie the dog does a bunch of intelligence. You know what? It's Lassie. Okay? So the story is, it's the old story. It's directed by Charles Sturridge, who directed Brideshead Revisited on television and that thing,
The Thing You Do?
No, no, that is Shackleton. Shackleton, you know, that great big epic production of Shackleton, which I didn't see, but I hear is pretty good. Lassie is owned by a poor family who work down the mine. They are short of money because the mine is closing down. They have to sell Lassie to the Toffs, played here by Peter O'Toole. And we know it's her, and everyone knows it's her, and everyone. So they go off to Scotland. Lassie goes home, basically. And she treks home a long way, and on the way she goes past Loch Ness, where there's the Loch Ness Monster. And there's cameos by Edward Fox, Nicholas Lyndhurst. Peter Dinklage is absolutely brilliant, actually. I think he's really, really good in it. And, okay, fine. It's silly, and it's, you know, charming and whimsical in the way that Lassie always was, and in the way of Disney's incredible journey. And it's really funny just how uptight critics have got about it. I mean, they've been really vitriolic about it, you know, and they've all done the, oh, talking like Lassie in their reviews. Well, you know, sorry, what's that, Lassie? A bunch of British critics getting uptight about a new version. It's Lassie! It's Lassie! It's a story about a collie who goes home to his, you know, her owner, beg your pardon, and it turns out that, of course, everyone's nice apart from the archetypally bad character, and it's Lassie! And I sat there thinking, this is perfectly fine, this is perfectly sweet. I had a couple of sniffles, a couple of cries. I very much like Peter Dinklage.
I did, of course.
It's Lassie! I mean, you really have to go a long way to mess Lassie up. The Manx countryside looks nice, although it's not meant to be there. The performances are all absolutely little cameo roles. That's all they're there for. And then the dog, I'm not giving anything away, the dog gets home and everyone has a family hug reunion. And you know what? It turns out that the poor boy and the rich girl, they can be friends after all. Because, hey, it's Lassie! In the BBFC certificate thing, it says PG contains mild language, which largely consists of sort of northern mispronunciation. I mean, not actual, of, you know, southern actors doing what they consider to be northern mispronunciations of words which aren't rude by the time they come out of their mouths. You can't quite understand what they are. I should say, however, in the interest of our parents who may take their children, there is one dead dog event. Obviously, it's not Lassie!
Right. But there's a dead dog.
But there's a dog dies, and that may be disturbing.
Enough of the dog, here comes the ape. A couple of reviews first, and then Dr. Kermode. Martin in Manchester. I was at the London premiere of Kong. I got a bit of a sinking feeling when Peter Jackson warned us to go to the toilet at the beginning because, and I quote, you don't want to miss the last couple of hours of this movie. So even he thinks the first 60 minutes isn't actually worth staying in your seat for. A whole hour setting up Adrian Brody, Jack Black and Jamie Bell, who simply aren't important characters. All that matters is the relationship between Kong and Naomi Watts. Everything else is fluff, but it's worth seeing for the fight with the T-Rexes alone. That's the best CGI action sequence I've ever seen. A real dinosaur's egg of a movie, says Martin in Manchester. Dr. Kermode, take it away.
That's a good pun, though. A real dinosaur's egg of a movie. Okay, so King Kong, latest remake of the 1934 classic original, which was remade in the 1970s by the De Laurentiis organisation. I think it was John Gilliman, wasn't it? And the famous thing about the 1970s remake was that they went to some trouble to build a huge kind of robot ape. I think it was Carlos, what's his name, who did the mechanics on Alien. They built this huge ape, but there's an awful lot of publicity about how much money they spent on the ape. Then when they started filming the ape, they realised it didn't look very good. And in fact, the thing that looked really good was Rick Baker in an ape suit. So most of the ape in the second, in the first version, you know, it's an animated model, 18-inch high model stop motion. In the second version, it's a guy in a suit. In the third version, it's Andy Serkis and the miracle of motion capture. And more on that in a moment. The first version cost a reported $670,000 back in the 30s. This has been reported as costing, and I say reported because you can never tell with these things, $207 million, which I think probably makes it more expensive than Titanic. There must be some kind of record involved in spending that kind of money. It's been a pet project of Jackson's for absolutely years, and it does stick fairly close to the original, though it manages to double the original's length. The original was around about 100 minutes long, and this is close to 3 hours. In case you don't know, the plot is set in motion by a Maverick film director, in this version anyway, Maverick film director who is basically told by his studio that his production is going to be shut down. He steals the cans of film, steals the canisters, steals all the equipment, grabs Naomi Watts, who he needs as a leading lady, and heads off to a ship on which he is going to go and find Skull Island, where there are legendary creatures to be filmed as a backdrop for his movie.
Is it any good? That's the question, which will be answered in a moment, because Bobby can do some travel. First of all, you have to wait about another 40 seconds at least. You've heard the story, you've heard the clip, here's the review.
Well, now, a number of things to say. First off, it's 3 hours long. As I said, that does double the time of the original, so that does make you think that there is a potential overstretching of the material, because actually it doesn't add very much in terms of plot. It sticks pretty closely to the original. There are several scenes that quote very directly from the original. There's one fantastically self-referential in-joke in which Jack Black, as he is trying to cast the leading lady for the movie he's going to shoot, they've got a costume that's in size 4, and he says, who's size 4? And somebody says, oh, well, what about Ray? Meaning Faye Ray. And he says, oh, yeah, let's go to where... Oh, no, I hear she's busy over at RKO. And he says, oh, RKO, huh? You know, Cooper. So here's this very strange in-joke in which he's looking to cast Faye Ray in his movie, but he can't because Faye Ray is working over at RKO for Cooper because she's making King Kong. So there's a little sort of ripple of knowing movie laughter, and you think that's just about as much self-referentiality as we can take. Now we'd like you to get on with the roller coaster ride. And boy, does he get on with the roller coaster ride. Jack Black's performance, which we heard in that clip, is surprisingly understated for Jack Black. I mean, I like him very much as a performer. I thought he was great in School of Rock. But he has, in the past, gone dangerously close to the gurning line. I mean, it was possible for him to be quite annoying as well as funny. And in this, he's really, really reined it in. And he was interviewed on a chat show in which he said, you know, that basically it was to do with moving the eyes rather than the eyebrows. I mean, he said it as a joke, but there is also some truth in it. He has clearly learnt how to diminish his performance and therefore make it larger. So, you know, plaudits to him. Plaudits to Naomi Watts. I've been very sort of up and down about Naomi Watts. Obviously, I didn't like The Ring. I thought she was great in Mulholland Drive. You know, when she's good, she's very good. And in this, she is very good. And it's very hard to step into that role because obviously Faye Ray is the icon. And then, of course, there's the famous Jessica Lange performance in the 1970s, which although that Gilliman film is looked upon very badly, Jessica Lange's performance is not one of the things about it that is ropey, but I thought Naomi Watts was pretty good. The first half of the movie, you start off with the stuff in the period setting New York, because it is a period set movie, and the evocation of New York is absolutely brilliant, particularly since it's all filmed out in New Zealand anyway, and there isn't a street of New York in it. It's a set and then CGI, and it's beautiful. There's not enough attention paid to just how good those early New York scenes are. The sense of the colour shading, the sense of architecture, the sense of play is really, really beautifully done. Then they get on the boat, and we know we're off for an adventure, and one of the characters, played by Jamie Willis, a thing that you raise, is reading Heart of Darkness. And why is he reading Heart of Darkness? Well, it seems to me he's reading Heart of Darkness simply because of one line in which, on the back of the copy of Heart of Darkness that he has, it says, you know, amazing adventures aboard a steamer. And just as they're about to land on the island, on Skull Island, he says to his mentor figure, he says, this isn't actually an adventure story, is it? And of course, as you know, Heart of Darkness, which of course most people now know through Apocalypse Now, it's all to do with, you know, going into the unknown and discovering something terrible about yourself. Of course, the irony of it is, in the case of King Kong, that when they go into the unknown, what they discover is a far more noble thing than themselves. So then we get
a 25-foot gorilla?
Yes, because the whole point... You know this. You're just being facetious. You know that the point is that the 25-foot gorilla is the noble character, and actually the baddies are the humans, as is demonstrated by...
Jack Black's the baddie.
Jack Black is one of the baddies. Jack Black is the human representative of the baddies, but he's not entirely bad. And of course, Jack Black does get to deliver the classic end line from the movie, which I suppose
don't
I can't
give it
say,
away.
Can't say it, but you said to me, it's one of the worst lines of the movie. It's like, Simon, that's like To Be or Not to Be.
Cheese.
It's like, it's not cheese. It's a, you can't make King Kong without that line.
It's cheese.
There should be a law against it. Would you like cheese with that, sir? I think Jack Black manages to get away with it very well. Now, the dinosaur wrestling and all that sort of stuff. Personally, I think from a narrative level, if you're going to lose stuff, that's where you lose it. Because it is very little more than just spectacular adventure. Because there's dinosaurs, there's incredible griblies, there's bugs, there's huge, really, really foul worms doing nasty things to a bunch of people, including Andy Serkis.
What a way to go.
As Lumpy the Cook. And you referred to this when he was in before, and I didn't understand because I hadn't seen the movie. But now I understand what you meant when you said the last time I saw you were diving down a hole being pursued by a worm. Pulled by the worm.
It's not giving it too much away, but he dies.
He dies, yes. No, we're not giving anything away there. The BBFC rating points out that it contains moderate violence, frightening elements, and frequent peril. Can I just say that that is a kind version of what happens during the gribbly spider stuff? Mm-hmm. I mean, I thought it wasn't mildly perilous, and it wasn't moderately frightening. It was. Remember, Peter Jackson comes from horror films. He comes from Bad Taste. He comes from Brain Dead. He comes from The Frighteners. He understands how to do scary, and when he does scary, he really does it. And there is stuff on that in the initial stuff on the island, which is really genuinely quite creepy. And I think it's fine that the BBFC have given it a 12 certificate, as long as people do observe what the 12 certificate means, which is if you've got kids under the age of 12, they might well be wigged out by it. Because I'm 42, and there was a good 3-minute sequence in that with the gribbly, creepy, crawly things in which I was really yucked out. I mean, the yuck factor was quite high. Great.
So if parents are going to be concerned about this, because we've already done a big thing about this because of the Harry Potter film, on a par with that, I mean,
it's scarier than Harry Potter because there's more of it. I mean, there is a whole sequence on Skull Island which is big rampaging, as you know, spiders, worms, creepy, nasty little insects, you know, doing horrible things to characters which are actually happening on screen. So all that's very distressing. But all that is window dressing. But boy, what window dressing it is. Until we get to the actual proper meat of the story, which is Kong's relationship with the Naomi Watts character. And it is here that the movie takes flight. And yes, it is true that there's a certain amount of spectacular padding up until that point, which some people might not like. Personally, I thought I was just getting my money's worth because, boy, it was spectacular. But when you get to Kong and the Naomi Watts character together, suddenly you realise that this is where the real heart of the movie lies, and it's almost as if everything else falls away. King Kong is a CGI-rendered character, motion capture, performed by Andy Serkis. He went out and studied gorillas in Rwanda, and then, you know,
as
here
he explained
in
last
London
week.
Zoo. Yeah, exactly, and he learned to do all their vocalisations. And I know sometimes it sounds like movie jiggery-pokery, but the fact of the matter is he's the star of the film. His performance is the star of the film. I know it's a computer graphic ape. His performance is what gives it heart because it's absolutely wonderful. Every minute that he is on screen, and there are some times when he's clearly not doing some of the fight sequences, as we said before, those are special effects things. Those are not specifically to do with circus performance. All the stuff with the apes, with its face, with its body movements, all the stuff that is actually to do with the apes character is all generated by circus. And, you know, give him an Oscar now. I don't care what the arguments are. And I say this, you know, there's no one more zealous than a convert. As we remember, I was the person who said, motion capture, that's not acting, that's just standing in. And wrong. You know, he is absolutely fantastic. The best scene in the movie is a sequence in which Kong and Naomi Watts are first together, and in order to survive, she has to entertain him. And she starts doing this kind of her vaudeville act, her burlesque act. And Kong watches her and reacts to her in this amazing sort of catalogue of emotions passes, you know, through this gorilla's face and through his features. And it's absolutely wonderful. And the whole movie, the whole of the rest of the movie could be rubbish. And that scene would hold it up like a tent peg. And I'd say it was still a great film.
I agree. That is an excellent scene. And the very, very worst scene is when they get back to New York and the ape and Naomi Watts go ice skating on a lake which would clearly have given way under the weight of the ape. And what is he going ice skating for? He's an ape. Well, I mean, that's... I just... No. Sorry. Skip the lake. Move straight to the Empire State Building.
Okay, the lake is a slight problem, although by that point I was in such sort of heaps and paroxysms of tears that I didn't care. I mean, yes, it's true, you look at the thing, you think, A, he would have sunk the boat if they'd managed to get him on it, and B, why isn't the ice cracking? But my heart by that point had melted so far that I didn't care. I mean, frankly, if he'd gone roller skating, I would have forgiven him for it. And then we get to the Empire State Building, and it's as spectacular as you like, and it's as moving as you like, and we, you know, everyone knows how King Kong ends. In case they don't, I won't say it, but for heaven's sake, it's King Kong. You know, it's like Sixth Sense, Ghost, Crying Game,
I think,
Boy, we've done all that stuff. But it's really moving, and it's really got heart and soul. And of course, the thing about Jackson, it has always been, yes, he is the Orson Welles of fantasy filmmaking, but the reason he is that he understands in order for fantasy films to work, they have to be invested with a real, proper heart. It's not just about the visuals, it's not just about the flash. It is about those things, because don't forget, King Kong was an exploitation movie. King Kong was a monster movie. And one of the things I like about Jackson's version, he doesn't forget that. It's like, you got 20 minutes, fine. You want to see two Tyrannosaurus Rex beating the hell out of each other? Well, here we go. And boy, you know, cover.
And that scene, and I know this is one of the ones that Andy Serkis wasn't involved with, but when he's got, when Kong has got Naomi Watts in one hand and beats three T-Rexes with the other.
Yeah, you go, as distractions go, it's, at the end of it, I did think, yes, it's been a long ride, but I never felt like I got less than my money's worth. And I did leave thinking, Serkis, you're a genius, and I loved that. I loved King Kong enough that the bits when Kong wasn't the centre of attention didn't bother me.
This from Pierce, who's listening in Dublin. Saw King Kong yesterday, thought CGI Kong was excellent and the set pieces were outstanding, yet the film is let down by a porridge of a script with dialogue straight out of the Titanic school of script writing.
Oh, Kong, that's not fair.
Kong is easily the most complex character on the screen, which would be fine if the film was 100 minutes long, but when it's 3 hours, you're having to spend a lot of time with the other characters who are generally hard to empathise with and about as much fun as a Celine Dion album. And what on earth is the point?
Harsh.
What is the point of Jamie Bell's character? Mark, explain.
Yeah, I think the point of Jamie Bell's character is to sit there, read a bit of Heart of Darkness, and then say, it's not an adventure, is it?
Not crucial, then.
Well, it's crucial in that line.
No,
it's crucial in that line. It's like the Gravedigger from Hamlet. Well, you're going to take it out because it's not crucial. But, it, you know.
This is Ben, who makes a whole number of points. It says, my fiancé and I saw King Kong last night. We both thoroughly enjoyed it, despite 3 hours running time. Andy Serkis was fab as Kong.
Yeah, he is, isn't he?
And created a truly three-dimensional character. George Lucas, are you listening? Jackson has created a truly exciting adventure yarn and managed to sneak in a whole lot of points about human relationships, rubbish film directors, and mass entertainment. Great stuff. Thoroughly recommended.
The rubbish film director, there is that great line when Jack Black says, trust me, I'm a filmmaker. She's lovely.
Sneak this in on the subject of March of the Penguins.
I want to do Joyeuse Noël as well. For
Mark and Simon says, Chris, I have a PhD in architectural history. I don't care. Simon and Lester, I don't have a PhD in anything. Is March of the Penguins actually any good? Check out last week's programme archive for details. Andy, I have a PhD in botany. I've just woken up. People are emailing in their qualifications. I didn't want to be left out. But I haven't seen the Penguins thing that go. And on your subject of how does the ape actually get into the ship, which is never explained because it just cuts straight to New York, this text says, as a master mariner, no PhD. Most ships of the period had a jumbo derrick for heavy lifts. Big ape or elephant, no difference to British seamen.
It's a really big ape. It'd have to be a really big crane. Anyway, we've seen the crane. We've seen the ship. It doesn't have a crane. Very quickly, Joyeux Noël, Happy Christmas, looks from the outside like a classic Euro pudding production, which is a drama set amidst the 1914, you know, football playing and carol singing ceasefire that sort of broke out in the Great War in the trenches, and has been covered in many, many stories before. Actually, this is rather well done. There's a very nice bunch of performances. Daniel Brühl, who's the guy from The Educators and Goodbye Lenin, who's really, really good. Gary Lewis as the pastor, who does a great job. Ian Richardson as a particularly evil bishop. But it's most remarkable for that. Alex Fearn, do you remember that guy who was last seen beating Little Mo in EastEnders?
And yes.
He's in it, and he's actually pretty good. I think that he may have, I mean, what do I know, but he may well have broken that curse of the soaps thing and have a good career ahead of him on screen, because he's really very, very, very able in this film. It's been nominated for a Best Foreign Film Golden Globe Award, and it wouldn't it wouldn't really startle me if it won. It's up against Kung Fu Hustle, which is a bit of a hard thing because obviously Kung Fu Hustle would be the audience favourite. But Joyeux Noël is very well judged, and I thought an uplifting little movie and a real Christmas treat.
Richard Harvey says, I don't have a PhD in either theology or zoology, but I'm a medical doctor. I think the penguins were created by the flying spaghetti monster, who after creating everything then planted evidence pointing to evolution. It's just as plausible as divine being. Anyway, movie of the week.
Obviously King Kong.
And we talked to Woody Allen on Monday's programme, though you talked to him on Saturday. We're having a curry and a beer tonight.